Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the first week of April. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton here with editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott of KUT in the Texas Tribune.
Rafael Soriano.
I don't know what that means.
What is that? Yeah.
He's picking on the fact that the Yankees relief pitcher yesterday sucked it. He was just horrible.
The Yankees are a...
they're a baseball team, Reeve. Keep
they're
up.
A group, they're a group of people.
Keep up, Reeve.
Well, the season is underway. We're going to be doing this for a while, folks.
Yeah, maybe we should start a sports Tribcast.
No.
This is it.
Anyway, think about it.
Yeah, it is, right.
well, today's Tribcast, even if it's not about sports,
such a jerk.
It's going to be sort of the same and different from previous Tribcasts. It's going to be the same in that we're talking about the budget, which we've done for the last 2 weeks, but it's going
to
be different.
What else is there to talk about?
It's going to be different in that it's not purely speculative.
Right. Now we actually know something as opposed to before when we didn't.
Right. Well, and luckily the budget is not just about numbers and money moving around. I mean, really, when they're debating these amendments, they're really debating other issues a lot of the time.
Right. It's about family planning, for instance.
Right. So why don't we start there, since you've brought it up, Article 2 of the budget?
Well, you know, I think that we understand now a lot more what was in play before. You know, the discussion was, oh, this is all about spending. And it turns out that, in fact, the budget was used by people with a point of view to re-engineer the way we set our priorities in the state. And, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. Anybody who complains about the outcome of this budget fight, whether it's on family planning or anything else, must be reminded that elections have consequences. And the composition of this House made it possible for these measures, which were, I would say, fairly hostile to family planning.
Well,
it possible for those measures to get passed because they had enough votes.
There's about 38% of the funding that used to go to the Women's Health Program. It still goes there. And a lot of it now goes to these crisis pregnancy centers, which are centers that have a sort of well-documented track record of providing misleading information about abortion services and et cetera.
Budgets are never really about numbers. Budgets really are about policy. And, you know, I mean, you're right. The elections have consequences. And if your people get elected, you get to control the budget. And that's the central policy document of the government. So
and
you get
you
to say, we're going to spend money on this. We're not spending money on that.
And if you stay home and you don't vote, then in essence, you forfeit your right to complain. Not in a constitutional sense, but, you know, honestly, if you decided that Bill White was too boring for words and you couldn't bring yourself to come out and vote in November, or you decided that the president wasn't as left as you wanted him to be, and so you were going to stay home, and ultimately that cost your guys seats in the Texas House. Well, the consequences of that were on display this weekend, because the budget that got passed was a budget passed by 101 Republicans, and it might not have been a budget that could have passed in a House previous to this one.
No, not at all, I would say. You know, I thought it was interesting, though, that in Article 2, the whipping boy was family planning.
Article 2 is Health and Human Services.
Article 3, education section of the budget, it was this prison school system, which I thought was very interesting. It didn't seem like that was a Republican issue, but it seemed maybe to be instead a constituency without a champion.
Right.
Kids in prison, not just kids. These are also 30, 40-year-old inmates who are trying to get a GED, high school equivalency.
Right, but the argument could be made almost not on the merits of the program, but the program versus something else that might be more worthy in the eyes of the people writing the budget, right?
Well, and the way that I heard it described at one point during the night was a difference between spending money on people in prison to educate them or spending money on people that are in high school and trying to educate them.
Right, only prison-like conditions.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Not actual prison.
Right. Right.
Well, either way, you have a higher chance of more people being in prison if you fund either side less. Right? I mean, you have recidivism on the prison side.
Right.
The old Mark Twain line that every time I see a prison being built, I think of the schoolhouse that should have been.
Right? Well, the problem is that all of these are binary choices, A or B. It was not A versus not A. It was always A versus some other.
Well, and this gets into sort of the big Democrat problem of the evening, which a lot of them, they took to white-lighting a lot of these votes, which means not voting. They're voting present instead of voting for or against, saying that we don't want to be forced to make these choices. We have money in the rainy day fund. You know, a more honest debate would be to bring in money from the rainy day fund. One thing I was wondering is,
explain that though. Before you move on from that, explain the logic there. What would the harm have been in casting a no vote?
Well, you end up voting against programs you might like.
They had a series of seven votes that were raids on family planning programs.
Right.
They ended up at the end of this, they took about $61 million out of family planning programs. And the way that they framed this was not simply a matter of take the money out of family planning program. Instead, they said, we're going to take this money out of this family planning program and give it to this autism program. We're going to take money out of this family planning program and give it to
Children's mental health services.
Children's mental health services.
So if you oppose on the record opposing autism.
It framed up as a thing of I have to choose between two things that I love. And the Democrats decided, or some of the Democrats decided, that that was a false choice, that they weren't going to do it. And so rather than vote yes for one program against another or no for one program against another, they voted the white lie.
Right, it was compared to Sophie's choice, Solomon's choice, Hobson's choice. Many choices were at stake.
Or pulling a Jason Isaac.
Right.
Right, yes. In the Speaker's race, right?
His first vote in the House was
Craft a new term now, actually, right.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, one thing I was wondering watching that is, you know, even if they're not on the floor doing that, isn't that essentially what budgeting is deciding, you know, which of the programs
I want?
Well,
the heavy lifting of budgeting is unfortunately required here. And look, I'm not going to bust on the Democrats for voting present or white lighting or whatever else. But the fact is, you're either for something or you're against it. And you may be for it in the broad sense and decline to be against it in the specific. But at the end of the day, we know what's going on here. The Democrats demonstrated that with 49 members and a minority, they don't have any power. It's something we knew going into it, but it was confirmed this time.
Well, you really weren't watching on the floor. You really weren't watching them write the budget. You were watching them fiddle around with the budget
theatrical.
That was already written.
So, theater.
What happens on these is you have these you know, everybody wants open government until you have to show up for class, right?
And right.
The Appropriations Committee met, I think it was something like 59 times to put this budget together. It's $164.5 billion. It's, you know, a bazillion pages, lines and lines and lines and lines of budget items and long, long hearings and everything. They write this budget. They take it to the floor. And over a period of, you know, roughly 24 hours, members pick at it. There's a special rule that they pass that they say the total price of this budget can't go up. So anytime you want to spend money, you have to find something else to kill. And so you end up with all these sort of binary choices inside the budget that's already written. You send it off to the Senate. You go to conference committee later in the session. And a committee of 5 House members and 5 senators will then massage this thing into a final budget that comes back to the legislature not for amendment but for a straight up or down vote. So a regular member of the legislature, this is their only chance to sort of stand up and go, here's where I stand on X, Y, and Z, which is why you see the theatrics. But it's also why an average member who's not on appropriations in the House or finance in the Senate has a real say in the ins and outs of the budget.
Well, and before we get to that next step, which is eventually getting to the conference committee, let's go back to theatrics for just a second. So one interesting debate that kind of highlighted how things were going that night or that second night. I forget which day it was. I guess it was the first night.
It was Friday night. Almost Saturday morning, but it was still Friday night.
So, what's the difference?
Wayne Christian got up wanting to move money from...
Yeah, talk about one guy sort of showing where he stands on an issue.
And was he trying to move money from the Wyndham program to pay for it? Or was it, no, if this was just a rule within an amendment.
Yeah, there were two amendments. For the first Wayne Christian
amendment... It was a doubleheader.
Was on if you have a program at a state-supported college or university that's for...
That has a gender
it was,
or...
It was services for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, transgender, pansexual, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Just off the top of his head, ladies and gentlemen, Reeve Hamilton. Anyway, so yeah, it basically said if you have a program like that at your school then and it's getting state funds, then the state also has to, or the university also has to fund...
Family and traditional values.
Family traditional values thing. So they kind of, that sort of set the tone for this. It passed overwhelmingly, you know, a bazillion to nothing.
This is an example of how this budget fight was not simply about the shortfall.
It never is.
And it never
right,
is.
Right, right.
And people who assume that all they were doing was cutting, that's of course not all they were doing.
Right. Right. Well, this is not the sort of fiscally conservative move that supposedly, you know, is the wave that everyone rode in on into this house.
I mean, he didn't really spend any money. He just said, you know, we're going to go for
of these fights that had fiscal notes attached made them more likely to
fail. If you require a new program at a university, it's going to cost them more money.
It comes in as a mandate.
So his second mandate was if you take the entire course catalog at a university, 10% of it. No, go ahead. What?
I was just, before you explain that, I was just wondering if maybe we already had the traditional family values centers on campus for those that have the Greek system, at least.
What family values do you subscribe to, little
drinking,
guy?
Drinking on a couch on your front lawn.
Come
I guess.
Come on. Right.
You know, that has some upside. I'm just saying. But
it's from Alabama, ladies and gentlemen.
You do everything on a couch in your front lawn. Watch the football
right,
games.
Right next to the washer dryer.
No,
right
but I mean, hunt deer. It wasn't really okay. So much about families. These other centers don't deal with families. No, it's about, so the, you know, certain socially normative behavior.
We ought to play the clip of Christian. Can
so
we play
have,
the
yeah,
clip?
We have Christian.
Ben, why are you stalling on this clip?
This is Wayne Christian with Representative Boris Miles. This was his thing, wanting to take, have the state colleges have 10% of their course catalog devoted to Western Civilization Studies. And here are a few questions that Boris Miles had about that.
So none of the history of African American or Asian American, none of that would be included in this, right?
Would that be included in African history? Would white European history be included in
hey,
African
Wayne,
history courses?
You really don't
courses?
Want to go there with me, man. You really don't.
Would
I respect
Spanish,
you. I respect
Mexican history be included in that? If it is, it should. But that's where we should study and get the truth, not the made up, not the separated. But if you're going to teach this one, that one, and one, whatever, whoever,
let's,
it should
why don't
be
we do, why don't we, James, Wayne, why don't we do Texas a great favor? Why don't we respect the state of Texas and let's pull this down?
Now, we should observe that Christian's amendment went down.
That one did go down.
Right.
Overwhelmingly.
One of the nice and interesting takeaways from this weekend was the observation that, boy, if you were a Republican, did your amendment have to be effed up not to pass?
Right.
Honestly, how screwy did your amendment have to be this weekend not to pass?
Well, this was the poster child.
And this is one of those, you know, Republicans, especially in Texas, have pushed this idea of, no, we are not just the white guys you think we are. They've got five members of the Hispanic Republican caucus, or five Hispanic Republicans now in the House. According
to African-American Republicans?
Two African-American Republicans. I mean, they, you know, this has been one of the things about having 101 members is you're seeing some diversity.
Right.
And they want to foster that. They want to keep that going. And here comes Wayne Christian with, you know, let's look at Western
right.
civilization.
Well, now you have people making the argument that, you know, people making the, this was not race-oriented amendment, saying it's just about knowledge and understanding where democracy comes from and that sort of, but the race element came in strongly on both sides, including Wayne Christian's side. I mean, he essentially said, he was talking about white European history and wondered if all these other events in history might belong to African history.
Well, right, as you heard, and you know, the mood in the House changed notably when this debate was going on. I mean, you know, it was an interesting thing, and I wonder if this isn't, you know, I don't really know, but at some point they decided, you know, we're not going to go straight through to Saturday morning and do the entire budget. At some point we're just going to go to bed for the night, and we'll come back on Sunday and finish the budget. And I wonder if this debate wasn't where they started making that decision when the House
let it cool off.
Yeah, the kids are getting tired. Let's just, you know.
Right. You know, the reality is that we, of course, streamed the whole thing on Friday and on
right.
Sunday. We watched it, obviously, too. And most of the days, both days, it remained civil.
Right? It was a pretty civil,
it was
you know.
Civil.
Well,
I mean,
on Sunday, it was almost like lightning round.
To Strauss's point to Jim Henson this week at UT, the process worked, even if the outcome may not have been everybody's wish.
He said he liked the process maybe more than he liked the product.
Maybe more than the product. I mean, you know, Democrats got in there and, you know, they threw a couple of punches on amendments, but it was kind of a foregone conclusion what was going to happen.
Well, so, and we started triage right after the budget passed. You know, in the day after the budget passed, they started talking amongst themselves. Strauss and then Pitts were at this Jim Henson thing over Texas Politics Project over at UT.
Henson, who is a occasional Tribcast guest.
Right, and a pollster for us and a prof over at UT. So he interviewed Strauss, and Pitts was there and talked to the press afterwards. And the message coming out of there basically is that what the House did isn't the final budget. It's going to get better. It's going to get bigger. There's going to be more money available.
Who's he talking to, though? I mean, I know he's appropriations chair, but does he understand that the membership overwhelmingly does not want there to be more money?
His conversation with us, with you know, a couple of reporters there, was that I have already talked to the chairman of the House Republican Caucus, Larry Taylor, to see what his caucus's temperature was. If I had $5 billion more, would they want to spend it? So that's the way he's coming in.
It's not very fiscally conservative of them, is it?
Well, it's pretty fiscally conservative if you've got a budget now where you're cutting $23 billion from current spending, and you're coming back in, and your unfiscally conservative budget only cuts $16 billion.
But I have to say, what I heard on Friday and what I heard on Sunday was no appetite to spend more money. The problem is not that we're not spending. The problem is not that we don't have enough revenue. The problem is we have too much spending. If they suddenly come back and add in $5 billion to the budget, isn't that going to go completely against everything they've said?
Well, I talked to Phil King right after the budget debate Monday morning, whenever it finally ended, and the end of the debate was Jim Pitts saying, this is not the final budget, let's get this through the process, get it to the Senate, and we'll do everything we can to bring back a better budget. And I asked Phil King afterwards if he was interested in voting for a better budget.
And he said,
"Boy, it really,
tune in next time." And
he said it. He said it. It depends on what better means, right? But he said, "There's a line in the sand for me and many of my members,
right,
which is no new taxes, no rainy day fund. If you have a way to better spend the money we already have, we'll listen to it."
Jim Pitts is acting like Eli Wallach in Godfather 3, trying to make peace between the warring factions of the mafia, and remember what happened to him at the end. He ate the poison cannoli. I don't think this is not a role you want to play. I think Pitts's heart is pure, mm-hmm. and I think Pitts is sincere, and I think if left to his own devices, Pitts probably would find more money and spend more money. I'm just not sure that the members want that, not sure that the votes are there for it.
And the family visited the Capitol Wednesday morning, the north side of the Capitol. You had Americans for Prosperity Texas, you had Empower Texans, you had Tea Party from Waco and San Antonio, the head of the Tea Party Legislative Caucus Advisory Committee, all speaking on the north steps of the Capitol to say, hey, Senate, do the House bill and shut up, essentially.
Hey, Senate, do the House bill. Shows up and puts $5 billion more, and those same people are going to be back over. You think there's a possibility this happens?
Yeah, you got to reconcile, be practical for a minute. You have to reconcile the Senate with the House. The Senate will not vote for the budget the House passed Sunday. They won't do it.
But the House, you
can't get the Senate Republicans on that bill, much less the Democrats. So you got to find a bill that both of them will pass. So the House isn't, you have to spend $24 billion more than the House spent for spending to go up from current spending, right? They're not going to get anywhere close to that. You could have the cuts that the House did, and everybody could go home and say, I cut the budget 7%. And you could sell that. That sells fine. And, I think they've got a lot of room in the House. The problem in the Senate is to bring up the budget for consideration at all, you have to have two-thirds, 21 votes, which means that you have to have all the Republicans and two Democrats. That's one configuration.
That's
so you've got to get two-thirds vote to bring this up in the Senate.
You don't even have all the Republicans.
The Senate's already said, listen, we need you to get public education to this line. You need to fund public education to this line. You need to fund nursing homes to this line. You need to fund Medicaid providers to this line.
And what if the attitude of the House is up yours, buddy?
Well, it's sort of what you're getting at. It's theoretically an easier sell to come back to your district and say, we cut the budget, we cut spending, and saved our school, as opposed to we cut spending as much as we possibly could, and now our school is gone.
And Mrs. Johnson's being fired.
But the revenue source for that $5 billion is going to be the issue, right?
Right. So the Senate's got this, the March of Dimes going on over there where they're, looking under the couch cushions and everything for all kinds of money. I think they're going to find mostly, everything I've heard is they're going to find mostly one-time sources of money.
For instance?
A pot of money that was set aside as an endowment in the tobacco lawsuits in the 90s. That's about $3 billion. If you accelerate all of the tax payments, the state business tax, other taxes, you basically say these are due earlier than now. For the current budget, you raise about $3 billion. If you decelerate some payments that you make, notably the Foundation School Fund payment to the schools, if you delay that from the last day of the fiscal year or of the budget into the first day of the next budget,
$1.8 billion.
All you're doing is kicking that down the road.
But it doesn't matter as long as
run by a college student.
Yeah, but as long as the thing balances. And you don't lose any services. Well, there's this great line about, on the last day, this is going to be a real mess. On the last day of the universe, when we have to settle all these accounts, well, we'll all be dead. Who cares? If you can do this without actually raising taxes,
right,
and without actually cutting any programs,
so basically
politically, that's a win.
It's basically all trickery.
Right.
And yet, Steve Ogden, who, you know, is not exactly Mr. Profligate in terms of spending, is complaining this week that the real problem here is the structural deficit
that
we're just not addressing.
Well, the problem that I just described is that we have these ongoing expenses we need to cover, and we have found all of these one-time sources of money.
So this is not fixing something in an ongoing way.
It's fixing it for now.
A Band-Aid on top of a Band-Aid on top of a Band-Aid.
Well, it's also worth knowing that you know, all of these cuts, when you hear the number for the cuts, a lot of times the cuts are sort of much more than that because you eliminate federal matching funds. That's the problem with the Commission on the Arts, which they basically took out. They took out all the money up to the minimum you need for federal funds, which basically almost, you know, has the potential to gut that program.
Right.
But, I mean, the cuts are even more than they sound like, some of them.
Some of the family planning money that they cut, you spend a dollar of state money and you get nine federal dollars. That's one of the best matches that in state government. And part of the reason that the federal government does that is because the cost of not having a family planning program is so high, it's cheaper for them to have a 9-to-1 match here than to have a 2-to-1 match over here.
So some of these people would rather be ardently pro-life than ardent fiscal conservatives.
Yes.
Correct. Is basically the message.
Right.
So at the end of the day, social conservatism trumps fiscal conservatism, as it does in most cases.
In that house that night.
In that house that night, as it did in most cases.
So is there any chance, in terms of trying to pass whatever version comes back from conference committee that looks more like the Senate bill, is there any chance of, you know, we had a gang of 11 that got rid of Tom Craddock. Gang of 30, right, that could form with the Democrats, and you got a majority.
But stop for just a second. You've got a bill that's going to come out of the conference committee that looks more like the Senate bill to the House, but more like the House bill to the Senate. You know, the Senate's coming in high, the House is coming in low, and you're coming out with some kind of a compromise you think you can wiggle through.
But don't you think that the senators feel like they can make their votes without as quick a repercussion as the House member? I mean, I get the sense in the House that they feel like if they don't toe the line, and the line is Michael Quinn Sullivan and everyone on the North Steps on Wednesday.
Michael Quinn Sullivan of
Empower
Texans. Texans.
Do we really have to identify him at this point?
Sure.
He's like the 151st House member.
But, you know, if they don't toe the line with him, then there won't be a next time.
Well, the senators, that's an interesting point. The senators, ordinarily, half of them wouldn't be up for election this time. But it's a redistricting year.
They're all going to be up.
So they're all going to be up. So they're all going to have to, in a year from now. You know, the Republican primary is in March of 2012. Right.
Everybody has to answer for this.
These guys are up.
All right, let me ask, you know whose name has not come up?
Todd Wiseman.
Rick Perry's.
Oh.
Does Todd have a veto on this?
No.
Is the governor going to sign a compromise that the House and Senate comes to? That's the question, because
They've kept their heads down and said, let's see what the Senate does. Let's see what the House does. Let's see what they are now in the position. You know, they were in the position of, you know, do this or else, or do this or else, or I'll never sign that or whatever. And they have now gone quiet and are in the, you know, I've talked to them a couple of times and the answer is usually, well, let's watch the process and see what happens. So I think they're going to wait and see what comes out here. I think everybody, including the governor, is waiting to see, you know, what the public's reaction is to the kind of votes that we saw in the House over the weekend. Is the public positive about those things? Is the public negative about those things? And how do we go from here?
Does the public give a crap? The thing that I wonder is, honestly, does the public even know what happened this weekend?
Well, the teachers certainly do. You saw that.
Well, you know what? But you got sort of the group of the day shows up in buses, and they come and they scream at the Capitol, and then they get back in their buses with their box lunches, and they go back to wherever they came from. Does the public know? Does the public care?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, there's a couple of things here that the public does care about, and in particular that I think the Republican part of the public cares about. One of them is nursing home care.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is public schools. They didn't move to the suburbs to get away from bad schools to have their schools cut. You know, if you're a suburban Republican member of the Texas House or the Texas Senate, you're in that position where you probably have at least one Tea Party at home, and you certainly have at least one pretty big school district and sometimes more than one. And you've got to basically balance that. And what those guys are doing now and through April and through May is waiting for public feedback. I think they're pretty uncertain right now.
But and yet, except for David Simpson and Aaron Pena, for very different reasons, they all voted for this budget.
Right. Well, is it not possible that they voted for it, but having gone through the process, they might ease up a bit? And David Simpson, that's an interesting quote afterwards. I mean, sort of voting with the Republicans to cut spending down the line, and then at the end of it voting no and saying, well, I didn't like the way we prioritized our cuts on this. Peña was a little less surprising when he voted against it because it's in more in line with his district's values, I think.
Right, but the question is, do Simpson and Peña stick with not voting for this budget when it gets back from conference? I mean, you know, none of the people you're talking about, Ross, and I agree with you, you've identified a subset of people who have the potential for problems here on the basis of this vote, but they all voted for this stuff.
Right.
They all did.
Right. So the question really is going to be, what's the final budget, and what did you do on the way to the final budget that is politically dangerous to you? You know, they didn't take any votes the other night that were a straight up, this takes money out of schools, right?
Oh, sure they did.
I mean, not a big...
Out of prisoner schools.
Out of prisoner schools.
That's
right,
different.
Right.
So they pass a budget that has $7.8 billion less for public ed, or has a $7.8 billion hole.
But if that's not the final result, that won't stick to
it. So if the final result is six?
So the question is,
five?
The political question that always comes out of these things isn't the general, it's the specific. Did you vote on a specific thing that could be used quickly on a door hanger or a bumper sticker
or
you
commercial? Did you vote against community colleges because you love art so much?
Right. Did you vote for pansexuals? Did you vote against Western civilization? Did you, you know, I mean, those kinds of things.
Well, the majority voted for pansexuals. Sexuals.
No, they voted for traditional values.
The majority wasn't
right.
Well, on the pansexual one, that's right.
The majority voted against Western civilization. But that's because we've always wanted to break off and be our own place.
What did Bob Garrett in the Dallas News call it today? The Federalist Republic of Perryland. Right. Mm-hmm. That's what we are now.
Right.
Right.
And hopefully we'll be the official Tribcast of. That
we may be the only Tribcast
in that whole country.
Right.
How about that?
And so,
you look like you're calling us to a close.
Yes. Are we ready to close out this episode of That Place's Tribcast? On behalf of Evan, Ben, Ross, our producer Todd,
Rafael Sol,
and Rafael Soriano.
Rafael Soriano.
Right. I still don't know
who
that is.
Couldn't close out anything. Apparently,
I know the feeling. Anyway, thanks for listening.